Security on the High Seas, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An investigation finds that some cargo ships headed for Europe are taking strange routes, sailing close to places like Syria and Libya, and that's stoking security fears.
People began talking about the idea of, you know, someone just being able to load a great big bomb onto a container and then ship it to a port where it would then blow up.
Plus, a young Syrian refugee pretends she's a doctor and demands everyone play along with it.
From the moment she put on that white jacket, she'd introduce herself and say, "Hi, I'm Dr. Fatima. How are you feeling today?"
And a food writer braves a taste of blowfish in Japan, which, if it isn't cut just right,
you're in trouble. You could die, yeah.
Find out if he survives today on The World. Europe has a security problem with the sea, and I'm not talking about the many migrants and refugees who've come into Europe by boat. I'm talking about cargo ships, lots of them, engaged in suspicious activities on their way to European ports. They could be smuggling a variety of things, commercial goods perhaps, but also weapons and drugs, and that's sparking fears of a serious terrorist threat. The Financial Times has just published an investigation into the scale of the problem, and Sam Jones is the reporter on that story.
There's about 10,000 ships that come through European waters every month, and around 540 ships in European waters last month did something very unusual along the course of their voyage. And that could have been a number of things. That could have been they turned off their tracking device. All ships are supposed to carry a GPS tracking device that allows authorities to locate where they are. But a lot of ships turn that off. We don't know why. A lot of ships spoof their tracking device. They say they're somewhere where they're not. Other ships simply lie about who they are. They say, "We're this ship," but it turns out they're not that ship at all. And other ships do things along their voyages that are totally uneconomically explicable. So you might have a ship that's making a declared voyage from one port in Europe to another, or from a port in the Middle East to another, as we wrote about in our article. But along the way, along that journey, it's not taking the nice direct route. It's doing something like going really close to the North African shore for a long way, turning off its transponder so no one can see it's there, and who knows what it's doing. And then it's going on to Europe. So there's a significant and rising number of ships that are doing this kind of thing. And that's got to raise questions for European security authorities, particularly at this time when all of North Africa and a great deal of the Levant of the Middle East is falling into deeper and deeper chaos.
If some of these ships are kind of being lost for some hours or days in these suspicious waters, how come the captains and owners of these ships are not routinely questioned right after these events have been noticed?
Well, simply because I think in a lot of circumstances, these events aren't noticed. So while some port authorities around Europe are very good at watching and tracking the ships coming into their docks and kind of asking questions about where they've been, others aren't. And so they're not necessarily searching these ships when they come in. They're not asking their captains, "Why did this happen? Why did you turn your transponder off?" And also, for some of these ships, they don't necessarily belong to large shipping companies. A large number of them, you know, hundreds in any one month, are ships that are owned by what's called single ship companies. And so you don't actually know what the purpose of that company is, you know, whether it is genuinely engaged in legitimate trade or whether it's a front for some kind of other activity.
Sam, did you speak with European security officials about what kind of they see as the worst-case scenario here? Do they see it as just about smuggling, or is there concern about some kind of terrorist assault from the sea?
Well, there has long been a concern about a potential terrorist assault from the sea, and there have been instances of loopholes in maritime security that have been exploited in the past. So in 2002, the Limburg tanker bombing in the Gulf of Aden, that was the sort of big wake-up call for how much of an issue this was. And right after that, people began talking about the idea of, you know, someone just being able to load a great big bomb onto a container and then ship it to a port where it would then blow up. As one former naval commander put it to us, so far that's the dog that hasn't barked. But there's no reason to suggest that that will continue to be the case. There are many, many more ports out there with poor security than there are airports. And so this is a problem that I think people are going to have to come to terms with.
And finally, what about the U.S.? Does the U.S. have the same vulnerabilities as European ports?
No. I mean, I think after 9/11, the US became much more aware of the problem to have a better handle on shipping and maritime security. And so the US really spearheaded the kind of move, the international move to have better standards.
Sam Jones of the Financial Times in London, thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you.
By sea or by other means, more than 1 million migrants and refugees have entered Europe over the past year. 163,000 of them have applied for asylum in Sweden. That's the highest per capita rate in Europe. The country also has some of the most generous benefits on the continent. But for many Swedes now, the question is, can they afford to continue to absorb so many newcomers? The World's Jason Margolis has more from Sweden.
When you get asylum in Sweden, first order of business, learn the language.
Vem träffar?
This is a classroom in the small city of Södertälje. It's known for being the childhood home of tennis legend Bjorn Borg, and now home to many migrants from Syria and Iraq. I spoke with Sevag Yemengen outside the classroom. He fled Syria and left everything and everyone behind. I asked how he chose Sweden.
Someone tell me it's Sweden is good. Help for school and help 2 years.
Over 2 years, Yemengen will receive close to $54,000 to support himself, his wife, and two young daughters. By comparison, if he went to the U.S. as a refugee, he'd only get a one-time payment of about $4,000. There are other forms of non-cash assistance, too, in both countries. In Sweden, it hasn't been easy for Yemengen, but he says he's grateful to be here, except for the winters, that is.
I don't go out because it's very cold.
After Yemengen picks up more of the Swedish language, he'll talk to somebody like this.
My name is Fredrik Möller, and I'm a senior administrative officer at Arbetsförmedlingen, the Swedish Public Employment Services.
Möller's agency helps refugees find work.
It's the best way to get into society is to meet the Swedish people at work, and it's also the best way to learn the language.
One problem, Sweden has a highly skilled workforce. It's tough to place many refugees.
For some people, it takes a year. For some people, it can take 10 years.
You heard that right. A decade to find work. And Sweden's generous social system supports them along the way. But increasingly, many Swedes are saying the country can't afford to do this. Sweden tightened its borders this year and may deport up to 80,000 migrants. One far-right party, the Sweden Democrats, wants to close the borders entirely to asylum seekers. The party is surging in popularity. Parliamentarian Marcus Wieschel with the party says beyond the economic strain, the new Swedes pose a danger.
A lot of them are radical Muslims. They're radicalized here in Sweden because of the tensions in the society, because of the segregation. They've ended up in radical groups.
His party has been labeled as xenophobic and racist. Some of its founding members were linked to neo-Nazi groups. Wieschel admits the party has had problems in the past, but says they don't tolerate racism. And he says the right wing in Sweden, well, it's pretty different from the U.S.
When I used to live in the U.S., I was actually active in the Kerry campaign of 2004, so I would consider myself a Democrat.
Wieschel says his party supports increasing foreign aid to help refugees stay closer to home. But for those who do come, they need to behave Swedish.
We have to make them understand that here in Sweden, it's our values that matters, our way of looking at women, our way of looking at children, etc.
Some Syrian migrants share that attitude.
I think it must be Swedish schools here in the country, not Syrians, not Muslims, not other things.
Sharbel Idris moved here a couple of years ago. He met his wife Safa, who's also Syrian, in a Swedish language class. They're both Christian, by the way. I asked how long they've been married.
1 year and 6 or 7 months.
No.
6 months?
Not 5 months.
Oh, okay.
They're expecting their first child and are building a life here. And both worry that Swedish authorities have lost control in immigrant neighborhoods.
They have no idea what is going on in the future, what's coming. It might happen exactly the same of Paris.
The couple is stuck, afraid of new migrants and the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment in Sweden. Homes of asylum seekers have been set on fire. Last weekend, a gang of perhaps 100 masked men roamed Stockholm's central train station looking to beat up immigrants. The attacks were said to be in retaliation for the murder of a Swedish woman, allegedly killed by a teenage refugee. I met Swedish author Fredrik Segerfeldt at a cafe and asked if Swedish society is starting to fray.
There is this sense in large chunks of Swedish society that something is wrong, that things are falling apart. The thing is, this feeling, this sense, is not supported by data. We're still richer, safer than ever before.
Segerfeldt is a rare libertarian here. He says Sweden should allow in more asylum seekers. He argues that Sweden also needs to create more low-wage, low-skill jobs to get people working.
The expenses for the government has become so high, we have almost closed the borders. I think we should still keep letting people in and give them fewer benefits.
That's tough to digest here, though. Modern Sweden is built on strong wages and generous benefits, and that presents a quandary. Can Sweden preserve its egalitarian values and social safety net and extend that way of life to many more people displaced by war? For The World, Jason Margolis, Stockholm.
One of the really tragic things about refugees is how easy it is for the children to lose all sense of what the future might hold in store for them. If the future looks bleak, you stop dreaming about how great it could be. So a photographer named Meredith Hutchison went into Syrian refugee camps in Jordan and got girls there thinking again about their future with that familiar question, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Most of the girls in these images have experienced the conflict in Syria, the shelling of their homes and their neighborhoods, and the loss of loved ones, and they have fled as refugees into Jordan.
Hutchison is with the International Rescue Committee, and she doesn't just ask the girls the question. Hutchison listens carefully to the answer and lets them dress up with the clothes and equipment related to the profession of their choice. She then photographs them in the confines of the camp. Take 12-year-old Haja, who wants to be an astronaut.
What I love about her image and what she says is she talks about wanting to be an astronaut because she wants to look at things from a new perspective and discover something that no one has discovered before.
There's also 11-year-old Fatima who wants to be a doctor and showed Meredith Hutchison what a transformative thing playing that role was for her.
So we went to the local hospital and she put on the white jacket and the stethoscope. From the moment we stepped foot on the hospital campus and she put on that white jacket, she insisted that everyone call her Dr. Fatima. So we'd walk through the halls and she'd introduce herself and say, "Hi, I'm Dr. Fatima. How are you feeling today?"
Other girls wanted to be teachers and architects, policewomen and pilots. The pictures are really poignant, almost as if these girls suddenly recaptured a glimpse of what their future could be. But Hutchison says the other big point is to let young women know they don't have to settle for anyone's idea of what an appropriate job is for a woman. She uses the photographs to spark conversations in the girls' families and in the wider community about how to give the girls the skills they need to achieve their goals and see a future.
For us, it's unethical to work with girls in a way that tells them that they have to limit their aspirations. So this is not about playing pretend. And just to give you an example, one of the mentors we had come to talk with the girls was a Jordanian parliamentarian, a woman, who was a refugee herself and grew up in a refugee camp in Jordan. And now she's a very powerful politician.
The future is still there. Meredith Hutchison is just helping these refugee girls imagine it more easily. You can see some of Hutchison's portraits of these girls. We've got them at PRI.org. Later on the show, Earth, Wind, and Fire, channeling the spirits of ancient Egypt. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Brazil is getting most of the attention when it comes to the spread of the Zika virus, but some doctors in neighboring Venezuela say the problem may be even worse there. That's despite official government numbers on infection rates that tell a different story. Simeon Tagle's with our Global Post team, and he's been following the outbreak in South America. What do the official and unofficial numbers actually say, Simeon, and how does that compare to the number of cases in Brazil?
Well, Marco, officially the government in Venezuela has said that there are 4,700 suspected cases of Zika. But the independent doctors I've been speaking with, epidemiologists, believe that is an underestimate by up to two orders of magnitude. They've been running their own models, and they're estimating that the actual number of Zika infections in Venezuela is anywhere between 250,000 and 400,000. And then when you compare that to Brazil, those numbers mean that Venezuela's Zika outbreak per capita could be more intense than that in Brazil.
Yeah, so if we are to believe the high numbers, why then would Zika prevalence be so high in Venezuela than in Brazil?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One of them is that the government is accused of not handling the outbreak adequately. The first thing that the government has not been doing is putting out weekly epidemiological reports. That's something that has recently stopped. So there's a lack of adequate information. The Venezuelan population has just really not been alerted until very recently that this is a risk and they need to do what they can to avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes. And then there are other basic problems in Venezuela. One of them is the fact that the many shortages that there are there include repellent. People can't get their hands on mosquito repellent in Venezuela.
That's a big gap between the official numbers and the unofficial estimates. Is this a case of government ineptitude, or is somebody covering up the problem?
Well, that's a good question. I think when you speak to the doctors in Venezuela, they feel it's a combination of the two. But they very much feel also, I think, that the negligence on the part of the government, I mean, it is that negligence. There's a level of culpability here in the way they've handled this. One thing I should say, just to be fair to the Venezuelan government, it's only about one in four or one in five cases of Zika infection that actually show symptoms. So wherever you are in the world, the number of confirmed Zika cases is always going to be a fraction, maybe 20, 25% of the real number of infections. But even there, you're still talking about a difference of at least an order of magnitude between what these epidemiologists think is the reality and what the government says it is.
Is there an increase in birth defects like microcephaly? What Brazil is seeing, is that happening in Venezuela?
Not yet. Based on the timing of when Zika is thought to have arrived in Venezuela, the first microcephalic births, if there are any, would be appearing in March and April. So right now, I spoke to the president of the Venezuelan Pediatric Society, and he's just extremely concerned about what may just be around the corner. And one of the things he's also very concerned about is that he and his colleagues have no way of predicting how many microcephalic cases there could be in Venezuela.
In Brazil, as you know, there's been this huge mobilization of public health workers. Even the army's gone out to kind of spot standing water and spray insecticide to kill the mosquitoes that spread the virus. What's the response been like in Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela's been mobilizing a similar response, but certainly if you speak to these doctors and other critics of the government, they're saying it's too little, too late. This really should have been done much earlier, much quicker than has been the case.
So Venezuela's healthcare system has been crippled by years of economic collapse. If in March or April babies in Venezuela start turning up with unusually small brain sizes, what can the healthcare system then be able to do for them?
That's a good question. And I think that there's probably not much they can do for them. I mean, they lack all kinds of basic medicines. One independent pharmaceutical association in Venezuela has calculated that there is a shortage of 80% of medicines in Venezuela.
Wow.
So if there is this wave of microcephalic births, it's a pretty worrying outlook.
Simeon Tagel in Lima, Peru, who's been writing about Zika in South America for our team at Global Post. Simeon, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
As we've heard many times, no definitive proof that Zika causes babies to be born with small heads, but that link between Zika and microcephaly is getting stronger and stronger. That's what the head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control said today. The CDC also issued new advice regarding the sexual transmission of Zika. It's urged men who've traveled to the Zika outbreak region to either wear condoms or abstain from sex. In some Latin American countries, officials have gone even further, advising women not to get pregnant at all for the next year or two. That's a government line in El Salvador. It's a conservative country, and access to birth control is very limited there. My BBC colleague Katie Watson sent this report from El Salvador.
We've driven an hour from the capital, San Salvador, to a small village called Tecoluco Arriba. Now, this is rural El Salvador, and it's a poor El Salvador too. The simple houses here are made of breeze blocks, there's no plumbing, and the toilet is a tent. There are three men in the field cutting reeds down and laying them out to dry. These reeds will then be woven into matting, and they sell them, or they'll use them inside the house. While the men are working, the women are having a chat with volunteers from an organisation giving them routine medical checkups. This is also a rare chance for the women to ask about what options they have when it comes to contraception. Although they don't like to use that word, in this deeply religious country, these volunteers prefer to call it family planning. Carmen Elena Facundo de Ventura is a volunteer at Pro Familia.
Some women aren't free to choose how they protect themselves. They hide it, so we do visits and we focus on counselling and take it slowly with them.
With growing concerns about Zika, contraception and sexual health have become talking points. In theory, the government makes contraceptives available to everybody in public health clinics, but it's a very different reality in these poorer parts of El Salvador.
You go to the health centre and they say there's nothing left, or if there is, they're past their use-by date.
Most of the time, young people won't go because they're ashamed. They're made to feel bad.
The problem isn't just about resources. Gang warfare has made El Salvador the most violent country in the world. Down the road is the village's health clinic, but ever since the man in charge was murdered last year, it's not been open regularly. Apparently, it's too dangerous here. The numbers are stark. Nearly one in three babies in El Salvador is born to a mother aged between 10 and 19. These are young girls, which for pro-choice campaigners makes the government's recommendation that women should not get pregnant even harder to accept. Kathy Buca works with the citizen group for the decriminalization of abortion in El Salvador.
The recommendations, as we've seen them and heard them, have only addressed women. And so where is the responsibility of men to take an active role in this and to take some action against sexual violence? Rape and incest are extremely prevalent.
With so much unknown about the Zika virus, governments are trying to stop it spreading in any way they can. It's not easy for any country, but the challenges here at times seem insurmountable.
My BBC colleague there, Katie Watson, in El Salvador. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, remembering a musician who blended jazz, funk, and ancient Egypt.
It was spiritual, it was uplifting, and it was very much about kindness, happiness, and joy. And that's what he found when he studied ancient religions, especially from Egypt.
What inspired Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire? Coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In modern China, it is totally possible to have top Communist Party officials and Ferrari-driving playboys in the same family. Totally possible. You're just not supposed to know about it. Or at least the Chinese government doesn't want stories about them getting out. But sometimes they do. Take the case of Ling Wancheng and his brother Ling Jihua. Ling Jihua was a top Chinese leader. He's believed to have handed over top-secret documents to the U.S. via his brother, Wancheng. The story gets even crazier, though, with juicy details like glamour girls and a totaled Ferrari. I turn to Isaac Stonefish with Foreign Policy for the details.
So what happened was Ling Jihua's son was driving very late in the evening at a Ferrari that he somehow managed to purchase, despite his parents' nominally very modest salaries as government officials. And he crashed the Ferrari with two half-naked and potentially fully naked half-Chinese women in the car who were badly injured. The son died. The women were paid hush-up money. And Ling Jihua hoped that this would be the end of it. But alas, he didn't get that lucky.
Yeah, so what happened next? And how did the brother Wancheng get involved?
So Ling Jihua's enemies used this. It was really a great gift that he gave them. They were able to use this to peg him on this anti-corruption campaign that China's current president Xi Jinping is having. So he was deposed and arrested, and Ling's brother got involved because ostensibly Ling Jihua gave secret documents to the brother. The brother fled to the United States, where he remains today. And the big news as of recent is that the brother might have given these secrets to the FBI, to the CIA, and the brother had access to some really juicy stuff.
What was in those documents?
So we don't know what was in the documents. We think that he had information about the security at Zhongnanhai, which is the very secretive leadership compound where China's top leaders live. Well, we think he might have had information about China's nuclear launch strategy, its nuclear launch codes, and perhaps even more damning to the current rulers, he probably had a lot of really, really damaging gossip about Xi Jinping, his family, and the families of those near him.
So what do you think motivated Ling Jihua and his brother, Wan Cheng, to do this? Money?
I think it's probably not money. I mean, both of them seem to have enough money. It seems like this was an insurance policy for both of them. And, you know, Ling Jihua, if he did in fact give the secret documents, might have done so because he figured that if his brother had all of this really great information, that could in turn save his life because his brother could trade the information back to Beijing for, you know, perhaps more lenient sentencing or perhaps a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, so take us back to that auto accident, the son of Ling Jihua. How did that kind of taint him in the Communist Party?
I think it was just so egregious. I mean, it's just such a ridiculous scandal. You know, the Ferrari, the speed at which it was traveling, the, you know, badly injured naked women in the car at the same time. And I think the perhaps what made it worse was that some factions of the Chinese leadership were able to use their control of the media to try to cover up the scandal. So not only was it this, you know, devastating scandal involving the child of a high leader, but it was covered up in not a fully comprehensive way. So, you know, if you're able to just completely erase it, no one knows that it happens, fine. We never hear about it. But if rumors of it are able to get out, those can even be more damaging than coming out ahead and managing the media narrative in the beginning. So you had all these rumors, the rumors bubbled up to a surface, and then, you know, not too long after that, boom, Ling Jihua is demoted, and then boom, Ling Jihua is arrested.
Yeah, so where is Ling Jihua now?
We don't know where he is exactly. He could be in a very uncomfortable prison cell, or he could be in a fairly comfortable villa.
And that brother, Wan Cheng, he's in the United States, right?
As far as we know, he's in the United States. You know, he could be in some sort of witness protection program. He could be somewhere in Mexico right now. We just really don't know.
It's a really kind of complicated story, but overall, I'm just wondering, it seems like it could have been used as a lesson to upwardly mobile Chinese, trumpeted to them as a way to kind of not be so unbridled with wealth and greed. Is that what's happening?
I think that's very well said. I mean, I think if there's one great takeaway for any top Chinese officials listening, it's keep your children in line.
Yeah, really. Our friend Isaac Stonefish with Foreign Policy, who often comes on the show to talk about all things China, thanks very much for explaining this little mystery to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Almost 4 years ago, Julian Assange walked into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and he hasn't left since. The founder of WikiLeaks has voluntarily stayed inside the embassy to avoid extradition to Sweden. There's been lots of discussion of Assange's legal status this week, but leaving that aside for the moment, what does living inside one building for that long do to your health? I asked London-based physician Sarah Jarvis about that.
Well, of course, many of my patients, indeed millions of people across the UK and across the USA, go through this all the time. The difference is that compared to Julian Assange, many of them don't have any choice in the matter. Many patients are housebound and find it very difficult to get outside. Certainly from our perspective, one of the biggest problems is lack of sunlight. And that means that you may well become deficient in vitamin D. It is very, very common, particularly in colder countries like the UK, and probably about half of my patients, especially during the winter months, are short of vitamin D. Low levels of vitamin D have been linked with higher incidence of thinning of the bones, osteoporosis, higher incidence of heart disease, depression, even cancer. But it is fairly easily rectified by taking just one capsule a day of vitamin D supplement.
What about mental health? I mean, that's the other challenge for Assange.
And I don't think there's much question that being confined to one building, whether it's a building, the Ecuadorian embassy or any other small place, could have a significant impact. Many of my patients who suffer from COPD, chronic long-term lung disease, often related to smoking, although not always, are effectively consigned to the inside of one room because they are too breathless to move around. And we know that having chronic health problems, whether it's chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease, heart failure, can have a significant impact on your health. It can be quite difficult to tease out how much of that is related to being confined to one place and how much of it is related to being physically unwell. But we do know that certainly feeling unable to get out could have a significant impact on your mental health.
Of course, mental health is related to physical health. I gather film director Ken Loach has donated a running machine for Julian Assange. What do you recommend to keep mental and physical health in top shape?
Well, we certainly know, for instance, that physical activity reduces your risk of developing depression. Keeping physically fit can be very important. There is absolutely no reason why Julian Assange couldn't keep his physical fitness up if he is prepared to eat healthily, to exercise regularly, and to avoid excess alcohol and smoking.
He could emerge from the Ecuadorian embassy both mentally and physically weakened. Will he still have what it takes to be the activist we know him to be?
I'm afraid I'm not a politician. Physically and mentally, there is no reason why he couldn't. I have never met Julian Assange, and I don't know what his current mental state is. But we do know that even people who have been through really enforced imprisonment, long periods of imprisonment, for instance, people who've been kept captive, kept hostage, say in the Middle East, have emerged and have gone on to live very, very full lives where they've done a great deal of activity for the good.
Sarah Jarvis, a London-based MD, thanks very much for your thoughts on this.
My pleasure.
For a lot of people, Maurice White was the voice of a generation with his band Earth, Wind & Fire, at least a generation. Maurice White died Wednesday night, the latest in what's already been a string of pop music deaths in the first weeks of the year. Earth, Wind & Fire continued to perform long after the hits ran dry, but for years the tap of Earth, Wind & Fire flowed with some of the best American soul, R&B, and funk ever, always climbing up the charts, and always with a unique touch of the band's core member, Maurice White, or as his brother in the band, Verdeen, called him, the pace setter. That pace was linked to Maurice White's own abiding interest in Kemet. What that is in a moment, let's just say it hinted at White's spiritual side. In his 1974 song called All About Love, Maurice White elaborates.
Astrology and mysticism and world religion and so forth, you dig?
It's all there, astrology, mysticism, world religion, and so forth, you dig? This wasn't shtick, it was as real can get. Renee Graham is a music writer here in Boston, often writes for the Boston Globe. She says it all came from a very personal place for Maurice White.
You know, this was never a fashion for him. You know, these things sort of come and go, and people decide, I'm going to wear this outfit, I'm going to wear this hat. He saw it in much more broader terms. It was really a way of living and a philosophy that informed the way he lived, but also had a very deep impact on the music he made. It was spiritual, it was uplifting, and it was very much about kindness, happiness, and joy. And that's what he found when he studied ancient religions, especially from Egypt.
Yeah, I was just watching a clip of him talking about how the spirituality informed the music. One of his Earth, Wind & Fire family members wrote in memoriam yesterday on Facebook that Maurice White was a practitioner of Kemet, and I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up, and apparently it's a term for ancient Egypt. So was this also about a reorientation of aesthetics and of black culture toward the roots, toward Africa?
I think it very much was. You know, I think that, you know, artists always seek and explore, and they're not just doing that in the present, but also in the past and the future. And I think what Maurice White found in ancient Egypt was this deep connection to black and sort of African culture, and the idea that we were kings and queens, that we were still kings and queens standing on the shoulders of gods. Spirituality was always his guide. And I think in Egypt he found not just this sort of spiritual and religious connection, but he found this connection to Africa. You know, and you have to remember, this was, you know, the late 60s into the early 70s, in a time where people were really trying to raise their consciousness and broaden their cultural basis. So I think that's where it worked for Maurice White, and that's what he put out in the music. And he managed to do it in a way that was never sort of preachy or overbearing. You know, he always understood that he was making music to entertain people, but if you paid enough attention, you're going to get some really wonderful messages as well there about Egyptian culture.
So the idea of ancient Egyptian symbolism, how far back and how far forward has this trend been kind of appearing in Black American music?
You know, you always see bits of this. You think back to Jasmine Sun Ra. You had explorations with John Coltrane and sort of looking at the place of Egyptian culture within African-American culture. And again, it's that idea of, you know, the cradle of civilization. We all came from this spot. This is where it all begins. But also the broader note, the notion of the pyramids, the pharaohs, you know, the ideas of rebirth, all of that was really informative for African-Americans, musicians in particular, but I think African-Americans in general. You know, you're always sort of looking back to sort of see what it says about who you are now and how you can bring that into who you are now.
How did that whole aesthetic affect you, Renee?
It was interesting. You know, when Earth, Wind & Fire came out, I was not quite a teenager. So early on, it was just about the music. But, you know, when you got these sort of beautiful albums and you looked at all the symbols, you wanted to know what was behind those symbols. Mm. You know, so you started to study because you saw symbols you recognized, like a Star of David or a cross, but you also saw the Eye of Horus, which is Egyptian. You saw the Ankh. You saw a Buddha. You saw all these different symbols, and it gave you this sense of a broader world outside of what you knew. You know, I was raised in the church, but suddenly here I was seeing all these other possibilities of things to look at and study. It was never religious music. Let's be clear about that. It was always, you know, dance music that was informed by soul and funk and jazz. But there was this deeper way that you could sort of find a pattern for living, you know, that you could be a better person, that you could use music and spirituality to uplift and not divide people. So I think that's what I really took away from Earth, Wind & Fire at the beginning and through the years.
Maurice White, I gather, traveled to Egypt, hung out at the pyramids. There's a great picture of him with an umbrella very close to the pyramids. Why do you think he was such a deep and devoted follower of these beliefs?
I think he was just a seeker. I think he was always that person. You know, when he was playing with Ramsey Lewis, he started to play the kalimba, which is an African thumb piano. And I'm guessing that in doing that, he started to look for more. I mean, that's what great artists always do. You start with one thing, but you never stop there. You're always looking for the next thing. And I think since he was already, you know, looking at meditation, at yoga, at ways of, you know, bringing his life to a higher plane and to bring the people with him along as well, I think that's what it was. I think he found that in Egypt in a way that he didn't see necessarily in other places. He was open to everything, but that connection to Egypt was always very strong and potent for him.
Renee Graham, a music writer here in Boston who often writes for the Boston Globe, helping us appreciate the world and the universe of the late Maurice White of Earth, Wind & Fire. Renee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I love it. Serpentine Fire by Earth, Wind & Fire, the late Maurice White on vocals there. I posted a great performance of it on my Twitter feed. Check it out. My Twitter handle is Marco Werman. Coming up, why some bonds in Italy are backed up, guaranteed with Parmesan cheese. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Pasta might be slang for money, but it's the Parmesan cheese that's making the big bucks. Recently, an Italian cheesemaker made this financial announcement. It raised more than $6 million in bonds backed by wheels of Parmesan cheese. Yeah, ask your broker. I asked Fabio Parasecoli, the director of the Food Studies Initiative at the New School in New York City.
I don't think that Parmigiano is valuable per se. I mean, it has an aura of reputation because historically it's one of the best known cheeses, both within Italy and abroad. We have documents from the late Middle Ages that already attest to the distribution of Parmesan all over Europe. And it is one of the cheeses that in the EU system is protected by a protected denomination of origin. So it's definitely one of the most visible cheeses in Italy, but I wouldn't say it's maybe the most expensive one.
What do you think is going on? I mean, what does it mean that an Italian cheese company has turned to their own product to guarantee bonds?
It's mainly reflects the state of the economy right now. The crisis started in Italy later than in the US, but it's been deeper and it's still going on. The consequence of this, it is very difficult for small companies to secure any sort of investments, also from banks. Especially, you have to keep in mind that many of Italian food producers are really, really small. When it comes to this sort of more traditional products in very specific places, so it's very difficult for these companies right now to get loans from banks. What they can bank on is the reputation of their cheese, the popularity of their cheese. So I think there are all these elements that make this bond offer plausible and successful.
I mean, my understanding of bonds, a bond is issued and sold to raise money for projects, and presumably the cheese would guarantee that the bond has value while it's being sold. That must also mean that there must be a lot of Parmigiano wheels around Italy to guarantee that, right?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, here we're talking about the wheels of a specific company. But the cheese is so well known, both in Italy and abroad, that the production is really, really likely to be completely sold out.
Is this a stunt, Fabio?
I don't think so. Keep in mind that the region where Parmigiano Reggiano is produced, Emilia-Romagna, is probably one with the highest standard of living in Italy. It's one where there are lots of economic initiatives. I think it's really a company trying to bank on the name of its product and the fact that they have a very good possibility to sell it all, to raise money for projects and to continue.
So you're Italian, Fabio. What is the one dish that you absolutely positively must have Parmigiana sprinkled on?
You know, the traditional tagliatelle with ragù from the area of Bologna, which is close to Parmesan, is perfect with that. But Parmesan is also very good as a snack to eat by itself.
Yeah, I love it that way. Just scrape a piece off and eat it.
Exactly. And with a little drop of balsamic vinegar, but the real traditional balsamic vinegar from Modena, it's absolutely fantastic.
And who knows, maybe if you eat Parmigiana today, you'll be eating a guaranteed bond. Who knows?
Oh, probably.
Fabio Parasecoli directs the Food Studies Initiative at the New School in New York City. Thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
Keep that appetite going. We're going to learn about a dining style from Japan that's on the rise now in the U.S. Food writer Steve Dolinsky is in the Japanese city of Osaka, and he's going to introduce us to kapo.
Kapo literally is two words. It means cut and cook. And it is typically at a counter, and you're seated right in front of the chefs, and they're doing all the work in front of you. And it's just, I'm sitting at a bar right now. There are 11 seats here. At this kapo, for example, eight courses will set you back 8,000 yen, which is about $64, going up to about $150 for the chef super special kapo.
What did you have in front of you this evening? What tasting menu did you opt for?
I had, by the way, I sent pictures, they'll be up on your website today, but I had a beautiful, on PRI.org, I had sashimi, but not just your typical salmon and tuna sashimi like we see in the States. We had fluke, we had shrimp, some beautiful squid, one of my favorite fish here in Japan, kinmedai, and then fugu, which is blowfish. You see fugu everywhere in the markets. This morning I was walking around, there are guys with the certificates, you know, saying they can cut up the fugu without poisoning you.
Right, because if you don't cut it up right and if you eat the wrong bit, you could die.
You're in trouble. You could die, yeah. Barracuda I had tonight grilled, which was really outstanding. Mm. And then some interesting tempura, a shiso leaf that was stuffed with blowfish eggs, and then that was lightly fried in tempura, and the tempura here just really delicate, really lovely. And then we had soup, but it wasn't your typical miso soup. We had bear meat soup.
Like from a bear?
Like from The Revenant, yeah, like from a bear.
From The Revenant. Not that one.
And, well, it was a bear. It was very fatty. But the chef here, Yutaka-san, really loves bear meat for its flavor, for its quality. But then on the side, he serves some pickles, oshinko, which go really well with this rich soup. Mm. And then some rice embedded with that kinmidai fish, giving it a little bit more sort of umami and saltiness. For dessert, super, super simple. Local apples and some strawberry ice cream. Strawberries are really in season right now in Osaka.
Sounds fantastic. So omakase is the word for a customized sushi dinner prepared by the chef. Kappa sounds like kind of omakase for a whole diverse meal.
It's sort of like the best of omakase in terms of tasting, and it's kind of like a kaiseki in that it's very elegant and elevated, and the presentation is phenomenal. But it is kappo in that you are sitting at a counter watching the chefs, and there's interaction. And so,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How much socializing and conversation happens between the diner and the chef? It's like you're one-on-one at the counter.
Well, if you speak Japanese, I mean, you go all night long. I mean, I was asking questions as we went through. What was that? How did you slice that? Where did that come from? And so that's the whole point of kappo, is that you're having this interactive experience. And so I just happened to, in between courses, asked the chef a couple of questions about what's it like going out every morning and shopping for people you're not really sure if they're going to be picky, or what that was like going out every morning.
I go to the market and see, but I always think about customers' needs, what they like to have. So really, I like to serve to my customers something that I really enjoy serving.
Yeah, so they come to a kappo knowing that I'm putting myself in your hands. You are the expert. You are the master. You are the shokunin. There's a good word for you, Marco. Shokunin is really someone who dedicates themselves to mastering something. So on this trip, I've seen shokunin making tofu, slicing fish. And so this is what he strives for every day, trying to make the best meal he can. And he does it in front of people all day long. There's no kitchen to hide in, because at a kappo, you're right on front and stage.
Food writer Steve Dolinsky in Osaka. Thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of your time there.
Arigato gozaimasu, or as they say here in Osaka, okini.
Okini from me too. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy your weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.